Welcome to the Parables of the Master podcast.
In this episode, we will be investigating the fourth parable of the Christ, Wise and Foolish Builders. In the previous episode, Lamp on a Stand, we learned that we must use our inner source of light to see our real nature. Recall that to be in the dark is to be led by subconscious choices and make impulsive decisions that lead to pain. The subconscious is ruled by an unquenchable desire for pleasure, because pleasure is necessary to avoid falling back into a state of pain. In that darkness, we can't easily see the inevitable pain that this constant striving for pleasure leads us to. To carry the light of consciousness into the depths of ourselves, it is to illuminate the subconscious, that part of our minds that's inaccessible to us. To see our real nature requires not interfering with whatever arises from the depths of the subconscious, because doing so destroys its integrity and clouds the truth. This requires being at peace with or fully accepting what emerges, irrespective of what it is and how it makes us feel. Though it's difficult to do socially or in the workplace, we must certainly do the work and relinquish all control in private during periods of contemplation or meditation. We must constantly analyze and question our actions, and in being honest, the subconscious starts to reveal itself fully. Our jobs are simple. Ask the question we want the answers to, and be 100% honest, and if we can do that, there will be certain growth. It is important to note that by being honest, you are actually speaking truth, even if that truth is a deeply hidden belief. If it is true at your core, and you speak it in full conviction, that is truth to you, and exactly the truth you need to progress. The only way to the truth is through the exploration of the dark, and therefore there must be courage. This is what it means to work. This is what it means to put it into practice, to question and to investigate yourself, that very truth you're holding and vocalizing in full conviction via our higher order faculties of thinking, is to do the work and be putting it into practice. Putting into practice does not mean to receive information and follow it blindly. In addition, it does not mean to engage in experiments of trial and error. There is no effort required in this. There is no labor, and therefore it can bear no fruits, or be beneficial in our lives in any way. Any living being can be trained to obey, but spirituality is not about obeying. It is about questioning yourself in order to find the truth. That truth leads to growth. And that growth does lead to living a life of self-obedience. To provide a bit of context, this parable was also delivered as a sermon, known as the Sermon on the Plain. Just as at the Sermon on the Mount, a crowd of people had gathered to see the Master. Their motives for coming were far-ranging, from simply wanting to see and hear him teach, to wanting to be healed, or perhaps even wanting to witness him perform a miracle. Leading up to speaking the verses of interest, Jesus had already delivered his teachings. He said, "Do not condemn, and you will not be condemned. Judge not, and you shall not be judged. Give, and you shall receive." He had also delivered to them perhaps the most difficult lessons to understand and live one's life by. If someone strikes you, turn the other cheek. Do unto others as you would have done unto you, and love thy neighbor as yourself. We need to understand that these lessons were contradictory to the Torah, the Word of God as delivered unto Moses. In the Torah it is written an eye for an eye, and the culture was built on similar principles. God himself permits the revenge in equal proportion to the damage caused to the victim. Now here is this new teacher, who is challenging the Word of God, preaching something never heard before. We need to understand that, in the time of Christ, the Torah served as judge, jury, and executioner. To deliver this message that effectively contradicts the Word of God is to be committing blasphemy, the only charge punishable by death. Let's dive right in and investigate this parable of the Master further, Wise and Foolish Builders. The Gospel, according to St. Luke, verses 647 through 649. Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I say? As for everyone who comes to me and hears my words, and puts them into practice, I will show you what they are like. They are like a man, building a house who dug down deep and laid the foundation on rock. When the flood came, a torrent struck that house, but could not shake it, for it was well built. But the one who hears my words, but does not put them into practice, is like a man who built his house on the ground without a foundation. The moment the torrent struck that house, it collapsed, and its destruction was complete. Jesus begins this parable by asking a question. Why do you call me Lord, but do not do what I say? One must be in service to and obey the commands of their Lord. Yet, Jesus is asking them to investigate why they call him Lord when they're clearly not his subjects due to their disobedience. This point has something to do with reputation and believing blindly. Jesus' teachings had circulated in the land and people started to know of him. They spread this message and, more specifically, were intrigued and fascinated by the miracles he had performed. Though they had neither witnessed or sufficiently weighed his message, they called him Lord. If one thinks about this point, it is to see clearly the nature of beliefs, rumors, lies, deceits, and how they spread amongst us. To call the Master Lord, but not obey him, is to be deceitful. It is to conceal the truth within and show the world a fallacy. It is to show the world someone trusting and obedient on the exterior, but be skeptical and doubtful within. To be open-minded and even skeptical are absolutely necessary for there to be spiritual growth, because that's what's required to give rise to questions. However, one must also learn to recognize self-deceit, because honesty is absolutely necessary to spiritual growth as well. If one keeps lying to themselves, there can be no growth. This is still true today. Once one's reputation is created, it lingers, and people cannot easily forget or get past it. Suppose we have developed a bad reputation at our place of business for being defiant, adversarial, mean, or difficult to work with. Our opportunity to make a good first impression on a new employee largely depends on getting to them before the reputation does. Even though you may succeed, it won't be long before that new employee joins the crowd, because eventually the gossip finds its way onto all. It doesn't matter whether it is true or false. It no longer matters if we have genuinely worked to change our ways. The perception people create is difficult, if not impossible, to change once established. Nobody wants to be hurt. And once we're recruited into the rumor mill, there's a sense of security there because the entirety of that collective is invested in keeping that perpetrator out. It is the same here. Jesus is asking them to avoid what they have heard and not refer to him as Lord unless they question. Questioning and studying the lessons is to put them into practice. And to arrive at some conclusion on our own is to find inner truth. If those lessons and that deep questioning and that truth lead one to a more fruitful life, then and only then may one call the Master Lord. How many of us pray to the Lord this way? How many of us actually arrive at that conclusion on our own through questioning and laboring over the spoken word? Yet, having not fully grasped that truth, we pack places of worship from wall to wall and pray, Lord, Lord. The reputation of Jesus was and continues to be predominantly defined by the miracles, and it is that which ultimately earns him the title of Lord amongst people. Yet ironically, it is via the simple spoken word that he's revealing the miracle of all miracles, that which we can have a real transformative impact on one's life and bring one happiness and joy. He's given us the keys to the kingdom of heaven by teaching self-control, to question and to think before we act. But we don't seem to care about this much. We're only concerned with surface-level phenomena, instead of constructing houses with deep foundations. We want to see the Master return to us so that he can levitate for us. We want him to turn water into wine, and we want him to show us how he walks on water, so we can look into the eyes of the disbelievers and in vanity say, I told you, that's my Lord. It seems that we don't really want liberation, more so than that we want to be entertained. We'd rather go on a magic show than to work at something that brings us real value. It's that reputation we value, and not the word, for anybody can speak, but to achieve miracles, that nobody can do. Would it not take a miracle to transform this world? To study the word of Christ through merely questioning the word and to investigate deeply is to perform the miracle of miracles. Indeed, to have full control over one's emotions and impulses, to think before you act, isn't not an easy feat, and frankly, miraculous. It is to see the outcomes you desire and to see the right actions you must take to arrive at the desired outcomes without trampling over anyone or anything. In essence, it is a way to predict the future. But this isn't miraculous enough because it isn't fantastical enough. No, the Lord must come from the clouds with sword in hand, riding white horse to avenge us from our oppressors. We don't need these fairy tales. They don't help us grow, they won't bring us peace, and they certainly don't transform the world for the better. We only need the Word and our commitment to ourselves. To change ourselves is to change the entire world. To liberate oneself is to liberate all of humanity. This parable is all about putting what we learn into practice. But before we can live life according to truth, we must first see the truth clearly. However, to know the truth clearly means to have already put it into practice. For the very act of questioning the information that arrives is to put the method into practice. Being attentive instead of scattered is already to be walking in truth. When Jesus says, if someone strikes you, turn the other cheek, he doesn't mean go out there and provoke an argument just so that you could put what you learned into practice. That would mean you haven't fully invested in what's being taught. You acted according to the surface level information, and in blind obedience, it led you to pain. To question deeply what this lesson means and conclude that it isn't something you could possibly do in the moment of rage is already to have put it into practice. It is to see the situation play out in your mind and your exact reaction to it. It is to study the lesson irrespective of whether it happens to you in the real world or not. It is to investigate why you can't simply turn the other cheek. It is to see the embarrassment of being publicly humiliated. It is to see your sense of pride that will not allow you to let this go. It is to see the anger building within. It is to see the inner beast emerging in vengeance to unleash its fury upon the wicked offender. In short, the lesson is necessary to acquaint ourselves with the inner depths of ourselves. If one plays out the situation in their mind's eye in complete honesty and believes that they can turn the other cheek, despite the aforementioned inner state that arises automatically outside of our control, then they either already enjoy a blessed life, or they need to keep questioning deeper to get to the actual truth. If we're honest and investigate why we can't simply live life according to the truth of the Master, that honesty, that inner light, will let us know why. It will reveal the truth within, which is far more valuable than memorizing lessons and hoping that when a similar situation arises, we can bypass the impulsivities of the moment and default to our catalog of ready-made solutions, such as turning the other cheek. But we're not robots, but rather, we're red-blooded emotional beings, and life situations invoke strong emotions that are bound to invoke impulsive actions. As we studied in New Patch, these emotions override our sense of logic and reasoning, and generally lead us to making matters a lot worse for ourselves. To investigate this point clearly is to ultimately arrive at the conclusion that the speaker of this message is asking the impossible from us. Could anyone possibly have lived his life this way? Or did they deliver this message as a way to challenge us and get us to question deeply? Now consider the remainder of his tragic story. If we can't possibly turn the other cheek due to a slap, what about being spit on? What about being lashed mercilessly? What about being struck with stones, threatened with death, and later nailed to a cross and killed? Could we endure it all without lifting a finger in retaliation? Would we go willingly and continue to uphold our truth? Would we live what we preach at its hardest, just to avoid deceiving others and ourselves? In that state of unimaginable pain, suffering, and misery, would we still have the sense and resolve to beg God Himself for mercy against our very abusers in their moment of ignorance and hysteria? Has someone like this actually walked this earth? To be that is to be the ideal of human perfection. It is critical to play out these situations and study them deeply and truthfully. If you were Jesus, what would you do? That's the power of consciousness, of our inner light. It uses information to construct a world more real than this one. It has the power to put us front and center on that stage as the story is playing out. It gives us the power to witness the story in the virtual classroom of your mind's eye, outside of time and space. It gives us the power to be in the skin of another to study a situation from their perspective. Above all, it allows us to get well acquainted with our true nature and see the complexity that dwells within. Do we want a God that is willing to give his life for ours, and in his infinite mercy, compassion, and grace die in self-sacrifice just to spare us pain? Or do we want a God that takes an eye for an eye in revenge? Whatever we think, or whatever we prefer to believe, is inconsequential. For in both situations, we have the exact same God that constantly works to balance the scales. God is that balancing force. But what's of more relevance here is how we interpret this balancing force. Forgiveness and mercy also have the power to balance the scales, and it need not necessarily come from a pound of flesh. To evolve mentally and spiritually is to evolve past scripture. With that said, assuming we want to be forgiven, we must forgive. Assuming we don't want to be judged, we must not judge. Assuming we don't want to deceive, we must not deceive. How can we possibly live life by these lessons? The truth of the matter is that we have all the tools to do so at our disposal, and we don't need anyone or anything else. That is, we have the power to balance ourselves, and when we're in balance, God dwells within. However, God, that balancing force, will not enter our beings until we align with His true nature. We must see that the same faculties of mind that are used to judge ourselves are also used to judge another. If we stop constantly judging and criticizing ourselves, but rather learn to accept ourselves as the product of all the balancing forces of creation, we shall never again judge another. It requires work to see that we're being judgmental towards oneself, and unless we snap out of it, it will run on unconsciously. We must see that the same faculties we use to deceive ourselves, we use to deceive others. If we stop deceiving ourselves and always tell the truth at the very least to ourselves, we shall never again lie, cheat, or steal from another. We must see that the same faculties we use to condemn ourselves due to guilt, resentment, and shame, we use to condemn others. Forgive oneself first, and via those same faculties we've labored to train in forgiving ourselves, we shall gain the power to forgive another. To love our neighbor as we love ourselves doesn't mean we need to go out of our way to forge relationships just so we can love them and live life by the words of Christ. No, it simply means to investigate the hardships and tragedies of others as if they occur to us. If we don't love our neighbors as ourselves, we're not likely to learn from their misfortunes and investigate them deeply. Rather, it is to simply observe as the house of another was swept up by the torrent and rejoice that it didn't happen to us. However, to love them as ourselves is to fully immerse ourselves in their situation and investigate their hardship as our own. This process reveals the weakness within our own foundation, and if that torrent was to arrive at our doorsteps, we would be just as vulnerable and be swept up just as our neighbors were. It is to realize that we haven't quite dug down deep enough and are living within a flimsy structure that's offering a false sense of security, a house of cards that's at the mercy of the elements. It is to see the weakness or complete lack of foundation, and rather than thank the Lord lightning didn't strike us, do the work necessary, and in our love for ourselves, treat that situation as our own and learn from it. Only then can one truly dig deep, find the stone, and construct our foundation on top of it. But we mustn't stop there, for great is our love for ourselves. This holds equally true for the blessings and gifts of our neighbors. This is comparable to the torrent striking their house, but they were able to withstand it and rejoice for having done so. If we don't love them as ourselves, then we can't imagine those blessings as our own. Therefore, we are more likely to drown in a cesspool of self-loathing, envy, and jealousy, instead of questioning even that fortunate situation as our own. To see even the blessings of our neighbors as our own is to uncover the truth at our own foundation, that vileness and wickedness that will ensure our destruction when the flood comes. Rather, we must rejoice with them. We must cast aside our pride and learn from them in order to strengthen ourselves and our foundations. Though we've labored to capture this critical understanding, there is a layer deeper that we can still go. Let's define the house, the foundation, and the rock. The house refers to our exterior because it is above ground, and it is what the world ultimately sees. Therefore, it is our body and conscious mind, and even though the mind isn't seen, the actions that originate in mind are witnessed by the world, from what we choose to wear, to how we treat others, and our general way of approaching life. The stone is neither created by us or was placed in the earth by us. Most importantly, the stone is not subject to the flood. We must simply seek and labor to find it. The stone is analogous to absolute truth, the truth that supports itself and needs nothing apart from itself. It is our inner light of consciousness, that which we can't dig any deeper than. The point where nothing is defined and the point that everything sprouts into existence from. To know there is an absolute truth that explains all of creation, consciousness, both the macro and the micro, even if we don't know what that truth actually is to have found absolute truth. The mystery itself is truth. That unknown within our core is the only certainty there is, and nothing can shake that truth. That is the rock on top of which our foundation is built. This is what it means to live a life of faith. Faith is the certainty that the absolute truth exists. However, it is also to have the certainty that the closest we can come to that truth is via the absolute truth within. That is, that mystery, that unknown, or even that undefined within us is the absolute truth. Belief, on the other hand, is the certainty that one is living their life in a state of fear. It is to hope that what you think you know is true. It is to hope that something out there exists that can explain everything. It is to run away from the truth of the mystery and call on your belief to bring you a false sense of security. It is a certainty that these bodies will one day die. That is not a mystery, but a certainty for one who lives a life of faith, because it is so and cannot be any different. However, that same certainty is terrifying to a believer, for they have no faith, and any house they construct will be without a foundation, above ground, and subject to being swept up by the torrent. The foundation that is below ground, but we must labor to build, strengthen, and fortify, is the subconscious mind. These are the faculties we must work to strengthen in order to see others as ourselves. We must not judge, condemn, criticize, or lie to ourselves in any way, but especially with hollow beliefs. These are the changes we have the power to make within that ultimately propagate all the way up to the surface. These are the lessons we must investigate to extract the truth from. The foundation is what ultimately withstands the force of the torrent, but remains unshaken, unemotional, non-impulsive to react and make matters a lot worse for the surface. Rather, it bears the force of the situation that's revealed to it in full clarity by its inner light or the stone that it's constructed on top of. To see the three parts separately is to see their dependency on one another, but it is also to see the three in one. It is to see your full self, you who labored to find the stone, you who labored to build on top of it, and you that now dwells within the well-built home are one and the same. Without you, there can be no stone, no foundation, no home, and thus no truth. The I am feeling or knowing you experience, without the need for the words I am, is the point of intersection, the absolute truth where the three are one. Therefore, to dig all the way down and explore the I am within and discover that each one of us is the spoken of Trinity, mind, body, and spirit, is to arrive at absolute truth. The house is built for safety and security. It is constructed for peace of mind. It is constructed to rejoice, to be happy and satisfied within. This is the blueprint for how we ought to construct ourselves, that no matter what rages externally, it shouldn't threaten our security if we have constructed ourselves atop a strong foundation of truth. That includes the hate, inequality, violence, rage, deceit, and fallacy out there, for it is all done in ignorance. None of those forces can shake a foundation rooted in stone. None of those forces can penetrate or invoke a reaction because the subconscious has been fortified. The birthplace of reaction has been constructed to withstand instead of react and collapse. This way, the torrent cannot destroy you, filling you with fear, regret, guilt, anger, or resent. The forces out there cannot be helped, just as hurricanes and storms cannot be helped. In the same way, the world is what it is. People are what they are. And the only thing you can logically do is avoid being swept up by the torrents. The only thing one can do is avoid dissolving in our own ignorance, anger, and hate by investing wisely in ourselves. The flood may be interpreted to mean death, but it certainly may also be the inevitable pain and suffering we're likely to face. To simplify it further, the flood is fear. Our security will certainly be compromised at some point in our lives, and we are sure to face hardships of all sorts. In addition, the knowledge of certain death at one point or another is constantly with us, buried down deep in our subconscious, so we don't drive ourselves mad with paranoia and anxiety over it. So long as we fear death, so long as we fear pain, suffering, and hardships, our lives can't possibly be governed by anything other than that fear. The spiritual seeker must become a devoted student of oneself, and in so doing, shall mature to the understanding that what we experience due to various life situations arises out of that inner fear. The life situations of all sorts that occur to us and all around us cannot be helped, because they are the product of the balancing forces of creation. They are the product of the eternal dance of order and chaos. Therefore, it is necessary to investigate this mechanism of fear further in order to figure out how it is that it rules us. This is what it means to dig. It is to investigate, but to investigate, one must first overcome the fears of the surface. You can't dig for truth below until you have seen and overcome the fallacies above. That is, you need to work on demolishing the house. We must identify all the beliefs in our lives that serve no purpose to our well-being and security. There is an element of fear to be overcome by doing this, and is entirely personal. To start on a clean slate is to demolish the house and clear the rubble. If there's the slightest uncertainty, it means that we're torn, and if we're torn, it can't be absolute, and thus serves no other purpose than to keep us divided within. Beliefs have strength because they contain this polarizing force in the opposite direction of that inner fear. The belief serves to be that balancing force between running and fleeing, to get us to ignore the fear. In standing still, the fear is temporarily suppressed or pacified, but it still lurks within, and when the slightest imbalance occurs, it rises and it is felt. That is to say, when something shakes the polarizing force of belief, which is necessary to retain the balance, that temporary imbalance causes fear to arise to the surface and forces us to counterbalance or react to get back to neutral. I like to think of ourselves as tightrope walkers. We live our lives treading lightly out of the fear of falling. Life situations cause us to lose our balance and we become afraid of falling. In reaction, fear automatically takes action to maintain the balance. That action, that flight or fight response, is the result of the tightrope walker instinctively shifting their weight or moving that balancing rod to once again become level. One should note that this mechanism of fear is absolutely necessary to one's survival, and the intent is not to destroy it, more than it is to understand its functioning. The mechanism is perfect, and it has evolved to defend the living being for millions of years. However, what it detects to be a threat is entirely our doing, and we have the power to change that. The lion, the tiger, the cobra, yes, these are genuine threats, but not what others think of you, not what you look like, not your past, and certainly not your future. Everything that invokes a sense of fear outside of a real physical threat is the demolishing process. When we lose our balance and become afraid, the reactions cannot be helped, because that is who you are. The reaction is genuine and sincere, even if it's not what society necessarily expects. You can't help the reaction any more than you can help who you are. Consider this. If you had to go against your inner nature, and it took every ounce of energy you had for you to handle a situation adamantly, you will probably end up feeling a lot worse than taking that gut or impulsive reaction. It isn't because you didn't handle the situation the right way, but it's because you had to lie to yourself in order to do so. You overcompensated in your balancing act, and if you pay close attention, this may have given you a sense of pride within. But why? If you did what you were supposed to do, and eradicated that fear and got back to center, then why are you so proud of yourself? To look at this is to see the overcompensation within, and to see that though you feel good, there's still an imbalance. It is to see that you're acting for the pleasure, you're acting for the reward, you're putting on a show for yourself and for the world, just so you can deliver your performance and take a bow afterward, as roses and applause rain down on you. Just because this other side isn't experienced or felt as fear, doesn't mean that it doesn't originate out of it. This point can't be stressed enough. Categorically, every time you lie, you do so because you are afraid of something. When your level of attention evolves to the point where nothing can escape you, these imperfections give rise to questions that are investigated deeply. That investigation is the digging that ultimately leads you to the stone. In New Wine, we thoroughly investigated the mechanism of belief, but here is necessary to once again say a bit more about it. Most people on the spirituality path do not actually change more so than they redesign themselves. In other words, they pull the bricks off of one house and construct another next to it with the same bricks, but still lacking foundation. They may look better, feel better, and seem wiser from all that they have absorbed, but it's surface deep, and it cannot last when the torrent comes. Suppose you dislike the way you look, as a lot of people unfortunately do. One day, you decide enough is enough, and I'm going to work with every fiber of my being in order to achieve the image of perfection I hold in my mind's eye. You work, and you diet, and you exercise, and you see major differences, and feel great, but only because that inner dislike for yourself has been temporarily pacified. After a few weeks of achieving your goal, you find that you can't simply be happy because you must constantly work to maintain your image of perfection. Or that image of perfection may evolve further to where you start to dislike your lips or your nose, and on and on. Though you're working to redesign and rebuild yourself on the surface, you will never find real peace because you haven't invested in a foundation. You haven't questioned your own inner dislike for your appearance. You haven't overcome that fear first. And because it is still there, it won't matter if you have transformed yourself into Michelangelo's David. Sometime down the road, you will start to chip away at even that masterpiece. If you find comfort within that new structure, you can bet that it would be short-lived. It doesn't mean that we have done no work. The work does have value, but not unless we can zoom out and see what we've actually done. We merely constructed another house with the same materials of the old, but still lacking a strong foundation rooted in stone. Though it took courage, in order to demolish that house, you more than likely used the tools of another, or the process of another that came before you. Beliefs are dualistic by nature. Thus, you will always find the opposite perspective wherever you look. Society is only divided externally because the same polarization that exists within each of us internally. It isn't difficult to maintain that division externally so long as we keep identifying polarizing issues. Abortion, immigration, foreign affairs, taxes, education, guns, death penalty, freedom of speech, and many, many others. These are all polarizing issues, and people will sway to one direction or another, depending on their inner process of handling fear. Some will run, while others will fight. The fighters think of themselves as courageous and see the runners as cowards, while the runners see themselves as smart and the fighters as idiots. That is, the real truth is eluding them all. They are each acting in accordance to their own self-preservation. They are each working to maintain the balance in a divided and polarized society. The only way society transforms externally is at the individual level by going within and addressing that source of fear. There is something to be said about divisions within and consequently the divisions in our society. So long as there is division due to polarizing forces, there is fear. And fear generates a lot of energy that is necessary for action. This action leads to increased productions of goods and services via labor. That is, society can be seen as one massive machine. And just like the engines use polarizing forces to generate work, so also is that fear necessary to boost production. The polarizing issues that keep rising up, like wars, gender, and even conspiracies, are the fuel. The combustion process within that causes us to side in one direction or another is the fear. The energy generated from fear must be released, and if one looks closely enough, that energy is either channeled towards consuming or producing. Consuming is the reaction of fear that causes one to run or flee in response. In other words, one spends for comfort and safety. Producing is the resulting reaction of fear that causes one to fight and channel that energy towards working to earn more. So long as one is constantly engaged in this process, it leaves no time for one to invest in seeing the forest through the trees and channeling that necessary energy to end the division within oneself. So, if you're wasting your spare time defending your position to these polarizing forces, or working to recruit others to your point of view, look no further than the cause of the real problem that perpetuates division and prevents change. It is you. I've seen individuals, whom society considers to be the pinnacle of human intelligence, doing nothing but engaging in the same dead-end arguments over and over, trying to educate the masses, and in the process doing nothing but increasing the division further, and therefore ensuring the continuation of the issue. It isn't just about accepting what the other side believes. Rather, it is about the futility of thinking that you have any real power to change it. You can't control the torrent. The most you can do is build yourself up strong to see it and sustain the impact. Real power comes from knowing yourself and working to transform yourself and not what you think you have the power to change out there. The absolute most we can do to change the world is to remove ourselves from the equation fully and become transparent to the mass hysteria. It is to see that any interference leads to making matters worse for oneself first and foremost, and by relation the world. However, so strong does the truth call within that you have no other choice but to interfere. You can no longer stand idly by from that light of truth and watch as we pour gasoline on the fire and wonder why the flames don't die down. The message you bring is not one of polarization, however, as that serves only to divide further. Rather, it is to point out that the real cause for your suffering is not out there in those issues you passionately defend or combat, but within. That surface-level issue, no matter how strongly you feel for or against it, serves no other purpose than to keep you suffering and afraid. Real power doesn't come from setting out to prove the doubters wrong or yourself right. Real power comes from having the courage to accept that which is exactly as it is. To simply see it and nothing more is to know clearly that no solution exists, and therefore it must either be artificially sustained, or it's not an actual problem that fulfills the definition of the word. All problems have a clear solution that one can apply to and solve. However, the only way that can happen with these polarizing issues that are currently plaguing this world is for everyone to either agree or be forced to agree, neither of which is a realistic solution that extinguishes the conflict, and thus it is bound to persist. If you can simply stop running and stop fighting to see that the only actual problem for you is being caught up in this artificial cyclical happening that goes on forever without any end in sight, is to get off the carousel. To protest, gas and oil companies but continue to rely on their products is hypocritical. Don't just change to that electric vehicle, but question where that electricity you used to charge it is coming from. The answer is that these problems only exist because there is a demand for them. There is nothing we can do to end the fallacy and deceit out there, because it is the foundation upon which this whole world is built. If that crumbles, we all suffer, and none of us want to suffer. That fallacy out there isn't something that can collapse suddenly. Rather, it must happen gradually, one by one, and drop by drop. It's not until you accept your reliance on the fallacy that you realize that the absolute most you can do is put forth a best effort attempt to break your reliance on it. However, just as before, we must start with ourselves first and work to break our reliance on the fallacy within before we can break our reliance on the fallacy without. It is at that point that real power emerges. You become that drop of fallacy that voluntarily fell into the ocean of truth. To step outside and see just one of these so-called issues clearly and what it is doing to you and the whole world is to have seen them all. It is a carnival ride, a complete circus. Those on the ride shouting, "Go faster," are the fighters of this world, the thrill seekers that would rather see the ride crash and burn than to face the boredom of their hollow existence. While the ones yelling, "Slow down," are the runners of this world. They're looking at all costs to condemn and point the fingers to the ones responsible for their same hollow existence. They do nothing but contribute to the increasing speed without realizing it, because they're too busy casting blame to investigate themselves. However, nobody's asking who's at the controls and who's pulling these levers. We're all convinced that there is just one operator, just one in control. This is true. It is the same, one and only I am that exists within everyone, but in its state of fear, is only concerned about itself. To see that we have the power to simply jump off that ride of insanity and watch as it speeds to certain destruction is not only to have found the stone, but it is to realize that you are the stone, and thus not subject to the flood. Thank you for your attention, and may God bless you.